Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 0.035% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching never changed anything.
Nancy Davis, my house, was inspired. I was reading the rereading parts of, I started off reading parts of Up From Slavery by Booker T. Washington. Then I listened to the book version, parts of this morning. So this podcast is inspired by Booker T. Washington's book, Up From Slavery. And today's podcast is titled Making Bricks Without Straw Versus Being Replaced. 619-768-2945. We'll be back with some audios right after this.
Against illegal immigration is often attacked as a racist effort by white Americans to keep out non-white immigrants. But one black civil rights advocate says, in fact, the biggest victims of low-wage illegal labor are black men in this country who see their own job opportunities dry up and their own wages undercut. Peter Kersenow is a member of the United States Commission on Civil Rights. He was also a candidate for President Trump's Secretary of Labor, and he joins us now. Peter, thanks a lot for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a position you don't hear very much, but makes a kind of intuitive sense. Unpack it, if you would. What do you mean when you say that black men in America are the biggest victims of this?
Sure. Well, just to give you a little bit of background, we've conducted at least three hearings over the last 6 years of the Civil Rights Commission on this discrete issue. And we had a number of experts testify. We deduced a lot of information with respect to the economic impact of illegal immigration on low-skilled workers generally. And all of the witnesses, all of the experts that we had who spanned the ideological spectrum, they may have disagreed in terms of the degree of the impact, but all of them concurred that illegal immigration has a devastating impact on wage levels and employment levels, and it's Econ 101, Tucker. When you have an oversupply of labor, the price of labor is going to be depressed. And also, we have an oversupply of low-skilled labor, and what happens is black males are disproportionately concentrated in the low-skilled labor market, disproportionately have only high school diplomas. And over the last about 20 years or so, the bulk of our immigration, or both legal and illegal, has been on the low-skilled side. So we have an oversupply of low-skilled labor. It has a particularly magnified effect among black males who are in that cohort. But it's not just black males. It's all low-skilled Americans. It's also having a trickle-up effect on other Americans also. And it has an effect on black females also, and it has profound sociological implications as well.
I don't even know what the counter argument to what you just said is. It seems obvious. It's clearly true. Has anyone told the Congressional Black Caucus?
Yeah, I have. On at least three occasions and probably more. What we did is immediately after deducing some of this evidence, and it's profound because we're talking about a 40% of the 18-point decline in labor force participation rates among black males is attributable to the oversupply of illegal immigration labor competing with them. So we're talking about, at the very low end, hundreds of thousands of blacks losing jobs, probably, if you do the math, up to 1.2 million blacks losing jobs. This has significant, obviously, impacts on the black community. Got in touch with the Congressional Black Caucus, sent them detailed information on this, asked them to do something about it, to respond to us, to engage in this effort. My assistant repeatedly would follow up on this. What we heard were crickets. Did the same thing with President Barack Obama, crickets again. And this isn't some minor matter. When we're talking about a labor force participation rate of 61.8%, an appalling labor force participation rate among black males, and again, family formation rates are affected by this, incarceration rates are affected by this. This may be one of the top issues facing the black community, but I've heard silence, but worse than silence, frankly. We've seen Congressional Black Caucus and many others embrace the open borders philosophy that's done such damage to black employment prospects.
This seems like a scandal to me. Can you explain it?
I think it really has to do with political imperatives. I really can't explain it going beyond that. I can't get into their heads. But this is something that is plain. It's unequivocal. It's not something that's complicated. And yet they've embraced an element that actually does egregious harm to the prospects of the black community. Again, I'm focused right now on the black community, but it does incredible harm with respect to all employment at the low-skilled level. And then we've seen what's happened with H-1B and H-2B visas. We can handle that smartly, but it's not being handled smartly, and it's affecting black workers. But I think that the political imperative of identity politics has trumped, no pun intended, the desire or the imperative to protect your constituents.
It's just so striking to hear someone discuss immigration in economic terms using numbers and social science rather than in identity politics terms. And I just wonder why more on the left don't do that. They used to.
I think I'm not an expert at these things. I'm just kind of surmising. But if you take a look at what they've been doing for the last several years, engaging in identity politics, I think they made a demographic calculation that if they're able to specify certain groups that they think that they can stir up so that they will vote in a particular fashion, that augurs to their short-term benefit, regardless of what happens to their constituents.
It's shocking. Peter, thank you for that. That was a great explanation.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this podcast is titled Making Bricks Without Straw Versus Being Replaced. And this podcast was inspired by Chapter 10 out of Booker T. Washington's book, Up From Slavery. in chapter 10 is titled, A Harder Task Than Making Bricks Without Straw. Booker T. Washington writes, and he's been gone for 105 years. Booker T. Washington, he's been gone for 105 years. He writes in chapter 10, from the beginning, from the very beginning at Tuskegee, I was determined to have the students not only do the agricultural and domestic work, but to have them erect their own buildings. Now everything we have is, you know, is the brick and mortar is ready made. My plan was to have them, while performing this service, taught the latest and best methods of labor so that the school would not only get the benefit of their efforts, but the students themselves would be taught to see not only the utility of labor, but the beauty and dignity that would be taught, in fact, how to lift labor up from mere drudgery and toil, and would love to work for its own sake. My plan was not to teach them how to work in an old way, but to show them how to make the forces of nature, air, water, stream, electricity, horsepower, the system, and then labor. Now I'm skipping a little ahead. Let's see. I had always sympathized with the children of Israel in their task of making bricks without straw, but ours was the task of making bricks with no money and no experience. Now, eventually, I'm fast-forwarding this chapter 10 of Up From Slavery, because they had a course on how to make bricks. Brick making has now become such an important industry at the school. Now, this is when he was alive. Brick making has become such an important industry at Tuskegee School that last season our students manufactured 1,200,000 of first class bricks for a quality stable to be sold in any market. Aside from this, scores of young men have mastered the brick making trade, both the making of bricks by hand and by machinery, and are now engaged in the industry in many parts of the South. And I believe, now, like I say, he's been going 100, Booker T. Washington's been going 105 years. This last paragraph that I read applies to the day. It's not a fact that immigrants are replacing anybody. It's if you're not, if you don't have the skills that are current for today, no matter who you are, you're out. I'm going to play one more clip on this replacement thing, and then we're going to get into teenagers who have built their own cars and built their own houses.
And opinions, of course, are running high and running rampant on this issue on both sides of this controversial story. Join me this time are two individuals who have strong opinions on illegal immigration. Let me introduce first Mr. Cesar Luna, an immigration attorney who represents the open border advocacy group known as Border Angels. And let's start with you, Cesar Luna. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, also in studio, I should mention, is Ted Hayes, civil rights activist and self-described America's alternative to Al Sharpton.
Yes, sir.
Let's start with you, Caesar. I am assuming you're in favor of the president's plans to liberalize the rules on illegal immigrants. Let me ask you this. How does this help those in America today who are unemployed and underemployed? Because it's sure. not just it's affecting the Hispanic community. It's affecting those who are here as immigrants from all over the world, as well as those who are born. How does this help?
Well, it's
unemployed.
First of all, it's not the best solution. It's a solution until we get Congress to really act on comprehensive immigration reform. I don't believe this whole immigration issue is going to be fixed. Now, with regards to who's going to benefit, undocumented immigrants amount the majority, as you probably mentioned, Latino, Mexican nationals, but also people from all over the world.
Of course.
Now, we're not affecting this change is not affecting unemployment because these people are already working. They have been working for all this, 10 years since they've been here? let's not forget we have 11 million undocumented people here that have not been competing with war.
All right, let me introduce Ted Hayes here. Ted, yes, civil rights activist. Cesar Luna brings up a point I've heard often on the left, that those who are here illegally are already working, so they will not impact the unemployment rate. Unemployment rate among African Americans stands at nearly 11% in America. I know this is an issue you're following closely. Do you agree with Cesar on this?
Absolutely not, no. Apparently Cesar's not really adept as to who we are as black people, whom I call descendants of chattel slaves and Jim Crow survivors. We have always had this unemployment rate, very difficult time in this country, and for people to be brought into this country to undercut our ability to improve ourselves is immoral. We're not in America, blacks, we're not struggling for a better lifestyle. We're struggling for our very lives. These folks, I know it's hard in Mexico. In fact, I'm one of the biggest proponents of against oppression in Mexico, Central America, and Guatemala. I consider myself their best friends. So I know their oppression. It's horrible. But they're seeking a better lifestyle. And their lifestyle is literally taking the life out of us.
And Cesar, my hat's off to you. You did say, look, this is not a good solution. It is a solution.
Right.
That is more than I've ever heard from anyone representing your point of view. And my hat's off to you.
Yeah.
But a solution that's not a good solution is a bad solution.
You know, let's keep in mind, we're not competing with black unemployment.
In Los Angeles, for example, we call it Occupied LA. We are being ethno-racially cleansed out of jobs, housing, neighborhoods that once were black neighborhoods, Hispanic, Latino neighborhoods, mainly illegal aliens. And any black that goes in those neighborhoods, we get beaten up. We get attacked.
We talk about employment.
And let me finish, please, sir. Please. We are losing our jobs and our housing, health care, education. We're overrun. No blacks are working in L.A.
The immigrant workforce carries different sets of skills than other U.S. citizen skill workers.
That's not true.
Well,
because give us an example of a different skill set.
I have clients. I'm an immigration attorney, and I have clients, companies, that come to me and say, Cesar, my farm is running down the business because I want employees, and I can't get them. I can't get them.
Will blacks work on farms?
You bet. Black, white, Hispanic will work on farms, Americans, if you pay them correctly and treat them correctly. One of the things that I made a big fuss about in the 90s, all of this issue, before I knew about illegal immigration, I knew that these people were suffering up in Northern California, mid-California, under the working conditions. They have to work around chemicals. They have to live in squalid conditions, no health care. No one cares. Those farmers are oppressors of what I call the campesinos and the campesinos, and that needs to stop. So no, we will not work
with
that stuff.
No, I agree with that.
Yeah, you agree with that.
I agree with that, and I agree that there are other industries. You talk about the hotel industry, you talk about the restaurant industry, you talk about all these very important parts of our economy.
Right.
There are no workers available. You talk about...
That's not true.
That's not true.
Again, that's not true because when it came time to paying the prevailing wages to blacks and white Americans and Hispanic American citizens, the greedy, self-centered employers wanted cheap labor. So they knew these guys would come in knowing that they're working hard or they have difficulty time in Mexico and Central America. They'll come here and work for less wages.
How can you argue against that? That the employer is suppressing the wages? It's not that the American won't work for it. The American won't work for it at the suppressed wage.
We will not be slaves again in this country.
I completely agree with you. And
but your folks will be slaves.
And I think there's black leaders. The overwhelming majority of the black community supports the idea that undocumented immigrants should get some form of immigration status.
That's not true.
Don't take it from me. Take it from the Pew Center. Take it from the Center from American Politics. There are institutions that have proven that this is a good idea to fix this immigration and to deal with this 11 million people of undocumented.
Earlier today, Loretta Lynch, President Obama's nominee for Attorney General,
yes,
said that those who are here illegally have a right to work in America.
No.
I understand the compassion.
Yeah.
I don't understand the legal right. Cesar, you agree with that?
There is economics, there's a social reason, there's humanitarian reasons as a country for...
Okay. Now...
Booker T. Washington's book, Up from Slavery, Chapter 10, which is probably my favorite chapter in that book, where the, like I say, the students at Tuskegee, they grew their own food. They fed themselves. Now, mind you, they didn't get a paycheck for this. They learned how to make bricks by hand and using machines. They had to build their own accommodations, all without getting paid. This is part of their education. And then went, because a great many of them went out into other communities, and then that's when they got their paycheck. Next song I'm going to play is a 13-year-old who built his own tiny house.
Hi, my name is Luke, and this video will be like a tour of my house. Before the tour starts, I want to talk a little bit about myself. I'm 13 years old, and when I started this build, I was 12 years old. It's been a little over a year and a half, probably a little less than that since I started this build. It is 10 feet long, 5.5 feet wide. The tallest point of the house is 10 feet tall. The lowest point is 8 feet tall, and it is a total of 89 square feet. The main reason I wanted to build a tiny house was I wanted something to do during the summer. I was getting really bored during the summer, and I got really fascinated with tiny houses, watching YouTube videos and stuff like that. So I decided that if I worked towards it and made enough money from cutting lawns, that I would start to build a tiny house. I learned a lot of it. I learned a lot, like framing, wiring, simple framing techniques, a lot of different skills I learned along the way, carpeting, stuff like that. Also, a lot of woodworking skills, how to use saws, drills, impacts, like multiple tools, and stuff like that. When I was growing up, I used a lot of tools, like a drill, impact, saws. I was really familiar with because my dad had always used them, and I would be exposed to the tools at a young age. So I knew how to use tools quite regularly, and it wasn't very much of a learning curve. Framing the house was a learning curve for me. My dad did a few remodeling projects and stuff like that, so he knew how to do it, but framing, I had no clue how to do it. Now that I'm done building, I think it's a very simple process, but when I started, I didn't know what to do. I started a YouTube channel probably halfway through the build, and I started to document my process. I wish I would have started it the day I started, but that's just not the way it worked out. But I hope to be building another tiny house here in a couple years that I'll be actually living in full time, and it'll be in a lot bigger size tiny house than this one is. So I kind of made this tiny house as the learning tiny house. So I learned a lot of skills, and by building this tiny house, and I want to take those skills from this house and move them on to a bigger tiny home. So the number one way I made money was by mowing lawns. I also did lots of bartering. So my dad's friend lives up the street from me, and he's an electrician. And I cleaned his garage out so his new car can go in his garage, and he helped pay and helped show me.
It's quiet. It's fast. And it only costs 2 cents a mile to operate. And it was all built by a 19-year-old. The desire to be green and save money on parking at Bainbridge High prompted Mark King to build an electric car of his own.
The reason why I built it was because the parking at the high school was $240, and I'm kind of one to find loopholes, I guess. So I asked why it was so expensive, and they said that it was because they wanted people to be more green. They wanted people to carpool, and I thought, you know, how environmental and how green can I be? So I went home, and I had thought about it junior year, so I went home and just started with the frame, and I built up from that. I I didn't know what I was doing, but I knew I could do it. I knew I would get there.
Built from scratch, the car's construction follows only the blueprints that appeared in his mind. The project took Mark 9 months to build and cost around $2,400. He says building the car opens his eyes to the possibilities of electric cars on the open market, and hopes more people will go green and build a car of their own.
I'm one that finishes things, so I didn't want to give up through that 9 months. I would work on it every night almost, and just coming in with aching backs and whatnot.
This is not the young inventor's first project. He also built an electric skateboard, a hybrid gas-electric motorcycle, even a steel-framed helicopter. And what's next for Mark? Well, yet another electric car.
I'm doing this because no one else is doing it. Like, the car companies aren't coming out with these things that they say that they're going to come out with. So I hope that people with ingenuity or without ingenuity go out and do this, because it's an awesome process. The amount that I've learned is ridiculous. I mean, it's a lot more worth it than buying a car. I really hope that someone else from BHS or from somewhere else on the island goes out and does this.
Mark doesn't have plans for college quite yet, but I'm sure he will be successful in whatever he decides to do.
She breaks the mold of what we think of as what girls are interested in versus what guys are interested in. She's an individual.
Welding, grinding, cutting, sanding. I'd much rather wear grease than makeup.
Her mind just works like an engineer. She wants to know why.
The project kind of took on a life of its own. Now there's literally thousands of people watching to see what she succeeds at next.
My name is Catherine DeMaria. I'm 14 years old, and I'm rebuilding a Pontiac Fiero.
All right, what are you working on today?
We're going to do welding first.
Welding first. Okay.
My car that I'm building is a Fiero 86 GT. It is going to be all black and yellow interior. And then the body is going to be gloss black with yellow racing stripes. My car is going to be fast and sporty and just cool.
Michigan has a great car culture, home of the Motor City. It's a great place to be to work on a car.
I'm going to be welding in the back of my frame rail right now. I'm going to do 1-inch stitches, so I'll have like an inch, no weld, and then an inch here. I got the idea to build my car the summer before I turned 12. I've been to one or two car shows with my dad before, and so that's where the idea sparked, hey, maybe I could rebuild a car.
She said, I want to redo a car so that it's done for my 16th birthday. And it's like, okay.
I just knew that it wouldn't work unless I had good reasons. So I'm like, well, if I build a car, then I'd get the experience. I'd be able to possibly look into future careers.
She's like, I'm going to pay for it myself. It'll be a car that only has two seats, so I won't have a lot of friends to get in trouble with. So we decided, okay, we'll let her try it.
Fiero, a brilliant example of Pontiac innovation in action. Fiero, only.
Hi, I'm Brian. I live in a converted school bus with my wife and three kids, and I'm going to give you a tour. Come on in. This is our entryway. It functions like a mudroom. You know, you can take off your coats and muddy shoes and put your shoes in the shoe cubbies or on the shoe hooks right there. And that way it keeps the rest of the house clean. So when everybody's inside, you can just sweep everything out of the door. This desk, you know, you can put your stuff down on the desk when you come inside. And then it also functions as a, like an office space. Take a folding chair off the wall. You can sit here and, you know, work on your laptop or whatever. When you're done with that stuff, you can stow it up here on the wire shelving. Also in this room is the circuit breaker panels and all of the solar equipment, battery bank, solar charge controller, and the fuse box. And then this room is closed off from the rest of the bus with a solid door. And this helps to keep the cold drafts out of the rest of the bus. This room gets really hot in the summer, and it gets really cold in the winter because there's all this glass and it's not insulated very well. So having a solid door really helps to keep the rest of the bus more comfortable. So right away is the living room. We have a lot of people in here, so we wanted this whole area to be seating. The TV is on a swivel mount, so you can pull this out from the wall and turn it so you can see it no matter where you're sitting. Benches have storage underneath. These lift up, storage under there. The lids pull out, these expand. And this one does the same thing, and they come out to about here, and you can put a full-size mattress on there. You take the cushions off and put a full-size mattress down, like an inflatable mattress. So if you want to have company over, they can sleep. There's outlets on either side. There's one on that side, there's one on that side. Everything that's, like, the cushion covers and the pillowcases and the rug are all washable. So the kids are in here, they make a mess, you can just strip everything, throw it all in a washing machine, and it's all clean. Yeah, just like that. This is the kitchen. We use portable induction burners that stow underneath the oven, so that frees up counter space. It's nice to have a big, expansive countertop. You can fold laundry on it. You can do art projects. You can, you know, prep meals, whatever. It just really, really comes in handy to have a big space to do things. This is a combination oven microwave with an adjustable wire rack. You can adjust the height, and it can function as a toaster. So that's fewer appliances to buy. Folding tables stow in a little nook right here for like a quick snack. Under counter refrigerator freezer. So the freezer down below. The fridge is up top. Propane fireplace keeps us warm. A single basin sink. It's kind of a smaller sink, so it saves on counter space again. We have all this for food prep or whatever, dishes and stuff. Up here, this rack is also a drying rack. So like when the cups are, you know, when you rinse the cups, you put them up here and they can drip dry. A drawer for perishables keeps them out of the sun, keeps them cool and dry, and frees up counter space. And then pantry storage, and there's also pantry storage under that bench. Extra pantry storage and an airtight container. Trash, recycling, and compost under the sink. So we don't have that much storage space, but it really forces us instead to be efficient with how we buy food and how we use food. By the end of the week, the drawers in the fridge are pretty much empty. There's really no room for extra stuff. When you're cooking and there's a huge mess on the floor, these are vinyl plank floors, so they're watertight, and so it's really easy to wipe off, and there's no gaps or cracks or anything like that. Really easy to clean. So we store the dining table right beside the washing machine. This table folds up flat, and it can comfortably sink six. And then we have a full-size washing machine. And this is really important when you have kids. We do cloth diapers, and with three kids, it's a lot of cloth diapers, so you have enough room to fit everything, sheets, the rug, you know, blankets, diapers, clothes, everything fits in there. And then instead of having an electric dryer, we have a big dehumidifier back here. We turn that on and hang all the clothes up and close the curtains. And that kind of closes off this little room, and this whole room turns into a big dryer. Up here we keep a broom and dustpan, small vacuum, laundry chemicals, sheets, towels. And then right here, this is our tankless propane water heater. It's very energy efficient. It's a condensing model. It provides hot water on demand to all of our fixtures. And then this is our bathtub. It's important to have a bathtub with kids, and a horse trough was really cheap and it has really high sides, so it keeps all the splashes in. And then we can use it as storage for our laundry hampers and our diaper pail when it's not in use. And then we have a drying rack up here also, and that folds down. Composting toilet is simple. There's no plumbing involved, no water consumption or anything, and it produces compost that you can use to fertilize non-edible plants. Keep all the cloth diapers in this drawer under the medicine cabinet. Mirror flips out. Medicine cabinet, and then there's another mirror on this wall. Just flips out. You can see the back of your head. Plenty of space to hang clothes to dry. You can hang them up here on the curtain rod. You can hang them all along this shelf. These, you can hang them on the curtain rods here. You can hang clothes on the shower. Pretty much everywhere you can find a place to hang clothes. Okay, so this is the kids' room. We designed it for three kids. There's three bunks. There's two over here. We have a partial wall here that provides a little bit of privacy. And the bunks are really long to leave some room for the kids to grow and also for extra storage at the foot of the bed. We use the baby gate on the top bunk to make a crib. So when babies outgrow the bassinet, they can have a home up here. and that's pretty secure. Not going anywhere. Third bunk. This functions in the play area. The mattress folds down, and then you put a mattress pad on top of that, and it becomes the third bed. And when you're not using it, you can fold it up. And then this becomes a play area with a hard surface so that it's easy to wipe off, easy to clean. And then under here, we have toy storage on more wire shelving, more toy storage underneath the bunk. Storage for clothes down here. And then this is our bedroom. Our engine is in the rear, so we had this huge hump in the back. So we put the bed on top of that hump. There's a full-size mattress. And then we have built-in drawers underneath the bed. Plug-in storage. And then under these drawers, we have shoe cubbies. My toddler likes to take all this out and throw it on the floor, so we don't even bother folding it anymore. Wall-mounted folding tables on either side. You can use that as extra desk space if somebody has some school work to do. We store a stool on a wall-mounted hook so the kids can climb in and out of bed, and the adults can climb in and out of bed. And we also take the stool, and we can put this over here so they can get up and down from their toy bun. All the overhead recessed lighting is LED, as well as these two wall-mounted lights. These are LED. All of the bus windows function. You can open all these windows if you want some extra light, some fresh air. And all the hatches work, too. We made cloth screens for the hatches so that the bugs don't fall on us in the summertime. We open these up, and they're like skylight. The whole bus is insulated with spray foam in the ceiling and in the walls. And that really helps with the climate control, too. It keeps the hot air in the winter and keeps it nice and cool in the summer, protects us from the sun. It feels like a lot more space than it is. I thought moving in that it would feel really cramped, but it feels pretty big for being a school bus. It's amazing once the seats come out how big of a space it is. It's a work in progress. I mean, it's not perfect, and I think we're always going to be adding stuff and changing stuff, but that's how it is with kids. You know, they grow and your space has to grow with them. But I think they like it. I think they have fun. Oh, excuse me. You want to come down? I think that's about it. Thanks for watching.
Well, the push against illegal immigration is often attacked as a racist effort by white Americans to keep out non-white immigrants. But one black civil rights advocate says, in fact, the biggest victims of low-wage illegal labor are black men in this country, who see their own job opportunities dry up and their own wages undercut. Peter Kersenow is a member of the United States Commission on Civil Rights. He was also a candidate for president.
Okay, we played that over. All right, so let's go to the phone lines. Making bricks without straw versus being replaced. I'm going from a Booker T. Washington point of view. He's been gone for 105 years. We played audios of a 13-year-old that built his own tiny house, a 14-year-old young lady who rebuilds cars, a 19-year-old that built a car for $2,400, not rebuilt, but built an electric car for $2,400, and then a young man and his family who took, this is a new spin on a short bus or a school bus, they took a bus and reconverted it into a home. Those are the skills that are some of the skills that are needed for 2019 and beyond. So hopefully we can do that and create innovative scholarship programs and funding ideas for the people that we run into, school age or not school age. Well, you know what? Everybody's school age. Let's go to our phone lines. 773, your mic is open.
Good morning. You got the completion of being self-sufficient. What you have just played today is the completion of being self-sufficient. I heard somebody talk about the
what is it?
overpopulated workforce.
I'll fix something for you.
The overpopulated workforce was caused by people not being able to understand that they don't have to be overpopulated workforce because they can create an industry of their own. Yesterday, I wasn't able to come on. I don't think I came on yesterday, did I? And because I signed up a young man.
Because Chicago had voting going on.
Yeah. I signed up a man yesterday that's making clothing and shoes. So we'll be putting clothing and shoes on the internet for sale as of today or tomorrow because he's already producing a product. You have to be a producer in this world if you want to be employed. You can employ yourself. I just looked at a video that came from Texas, my wife and I, or our grandson. He has created two incomes for himself, and he's 20 years old. Two incomes. One, he's a barber. That's one income. Two, he's a musician. That's his second income. He was just working last night that he sent us the video that he's getting paid. He made $100 last night. $100 last night playing drums at a lounge, a nightclub. That's two incomes for this young man. 20 years old. What are you talking about when you talk about you are overpopulated with labor? This young boy started playing drums in our kitchen, tearing up the kitchenware in our kitchen. So what we did was we went out and bought him a set of drums. He'd been playing drums since he was 2 years old. All of these things that we are using today, we are using these things because there was somebody that had a vision that they want to produce whatever it was for themselves. Look at the airplanes that we ride in all over the world today. Those guys had a vision. They produced airplanes back when they began, and now we're flying all over the world in airplanes. We talk about immigrants. Everybody in this country at one time was an immigrant, before and after slavery. This country do not belong to no one person or persons or nationalities. Country belongs to everybody that God put on this planet. And when people go to talking that old immigrant stuff, I like to see one person that wasn't an immigrant at some point in time that's in this country today. One person. So all of this stuff is man-made because of greed. People want to work people for nothing, and get rich so they can lay on the beach. All of that stuff is over. That stuff is over because all of the things that we are doing today was put into schools so that we could learn how to do industry. There is no system in the schools today because they all have been taken out because of greed. And listen to this one. They can go to another country and get stuff produced for a lesser cause because the union in this country says, no, you got to pay a better wage. We got to look at the overall picture of how greed has destroyed America and are destroying America. I want somebody to go to look at the riots that we had in Chicago alone 100 years ago, the 100 years ago riots in Chicago. There was rioting that took the lives of, I believe it's 30-some-odd people. 30-some-odd black people died in a riot. And here, right in our lifetime, within 100 years, Dr. King went and asked people to give us a job and got killed in 1963. Why weren't we producing product of consumption back then? because we was asking somebody else to give us a job. I think we've been handed ass backwards for years. You can't legislate people to care anything about you or love you. You got the right idea, L.A. Have these children to make the cars that they need transportation for. You have the right idea to build the housing like I was born and we helped to build the house that I lived in when I was a child. Have the children to build the houses that we live in the communities. That's common sense. And then you stack all these laws on top of stuff to keep people from learning how to do things like black folks in slavery wasn't allowed to read and write. That's over. Let's get about the business of being individually and collectively independent so that we as a people can live a good life on this earth that God gave us. I don't know what's wrong with some of our people.
Well, Pleasant, speaking of that now, because I know his Chicago yesterday was you guys were voting, so I know you were busy out there, and looks like Chicago's going to have their first, I guess we have to wait till April, to have their first African-American woman as mayor of Chicago. So that's exciting. But now you've got a son who's got a garage. Now I was now in a Jewish community, Jewish people have Saturday school. So what I'm thinking, because in light of some of these audios I played this morning, you know, where you had a 19-year-old, he built an electric car for $2,400. You had the audio I played this morning. I had another young lady, 14, she rebuilds cars. 13-year-old builds tiny houses. So I'm thinking, I mean, you have to run this past your son. But up in your neck of the woods, up in Illinois, if something can be organized where that might be able to be taught how to rebuild or build cars, up, you know. You know, I don't know if your son's interested in anything like that, but because that could be proved to be a lucrative venture, which can help finance teen projects, and if they want to go to college or any other kind of school that requires money, they got a skill that they can generate income from. So I was, you know, just tossing that out there to you.
You know what I like, L.A.? I like that one-room schoolhouse you talked about doing in Taft, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
The skill sets that's going to be put in the schools that we build is not going to get hard to get into financing from the mother folks because they don't want you to have skill sets. They took the skill sets out. They took out the skill sets so that you wouldn't have the opportunity to learn, and we got to write the books so that we can teach our children the skill sets that's needed to survive and enjoy the pleasures of being in America. Those skill sets was already here one time. They were here.
Right.
They were in our schools, all of our schools.
Well, that's how a place like Taft and Hopkins Park and these other townships were built.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the slaves that were freed, basically that were slaves who had, I mean, when slavery was legal, a lot of them who were able to buy their own freedom and buy the freedom of family members had skill sets of carpentry, furniture making, house building, infrastructure stuff. They had those skill sets, and this is during slavery. And then even when they had the original back to Africa trips to Liberia, what we call Liberia now, Sierra Leone, some of those people have those skill sets where they can get off the boat and build. I mean, from scratch. So that's what I'm looking at today. It's not so much we're being replaced. That's why I like Chapter 10 in Booker T. Washington's book, Up from Slavery, because they took, like, bricklaying. They took people that didn't know anything about bricks and then taught them how to make bricks and then were able to convert that skill into an industry. So that's where we are today, in my opinion, in 2019.
Yeah, we got to start to produce. And let's face it, who in the world taught folks how to farm this land that we own? We taught ourselves how to farm. We taught ourselves how to produce. And who taught us how to produce a cotton gin to make clothes? We did. We taught ourselves. We even made the cotton gin. Who taught us how to make it?
A lot of the slaves that came over already had some of these skill sets when they got off the boat.
That's right.
Some of them already had a skill set.
All we got to do is put that. We have to be in charge, and the only way to be in charge is to own it. We have to own the factories. We just signed up a guy yesterday that got a line of clothing, T-shirts. He got a line of T-shirts you'll see on the Internet today or tomorrow that Elzor is posting. I think it's 7 or 8 lines, different lines of T-shirts that's going to be sold. This comes from way back with Roebuck when he opened up the catalog business. It's just another arm of what Roebuck did way back 100 years ago. So what do we do? We are bringing back the opportunities so our children can have a good living and their children and pass this generation of wealth on to our children. We didn't have
let's
that opportunity.
True. Let's go to our next caller here. 718, your mic is open.
Hello, everyone. This is Al from New York. What I think we should do, that's good. Bricks is modern-day stuff. Maybe not, because, when you go back to mud cabins, huts and stuff like that, things are more complicated, more sophisticated, more modern. Because at one time we lived, and then we said, it's raining. Let's get out the rain. We went out from just living on the land. Then we went into caves. Then we went out from caves, and we went into, mud huts or, woven huts. And then we started building log cabins. But I think what we need to do, a lot of these things that we see a lot of people, coaches around the world that don't have, I think we need to go back to, because what happened, we have to flee. For some type of reason, we have to flee, or we are someplace, and we need shelter. I think we should start to learn how to build log cabins again. And if we don't have nails or whatever we have, learn how to make a sledgehammer out of rock and wood and, like that, how they used to carve that wood, like the caveman do, or put a rock between it. So let's learn how to build stuff off the land and see a big boulder. Okay, we take that boulder and we turn that boulder into a sledgehammer. Break a piece of branch off and tie some vines around it and make a sledgehammer. I think that's what we need to do. Let's, before we start putting up all these modern structures, let's learn how to build a log cabin. That, because there's a lot of things out there, like the there's a lot of trees out there. So let's start with that. Let's start learning how to deal with the things around us that we don't have to pay for. Cut down the tree, clear the land, and all that grass that we got, and let's turn that into fuel. So if we're going to do something modern, like we cut somebody's grass, just don't throw it away. Let's see if we can turn that into some fuel. Maybe it's some big old tanker laying around, something like that. And that'll be our storage. So we'll dig something in the ground, and we get some sheets of metal, and then, we get some welder, and that's our storage thing to put the fuel in the ground or something like that. Because you say you have a lot of acres over the place, L.A. So either we clear that land, that grass, and maybe that can be our fuel source, something we don't have to pay for. Or, you know, cause I mentioned to you, like corn, and, you know, grow some corn on your land and turn that to fuel. But, hey, before the corn comes in there, before you clear that land, we have grass and stuff like that. So maybe all them trees we do, we can turn that into some type of fuel, clear the land. You said it's millions of acres out there. So once we grasp that land, all that cheese or white, that vegetation, we can cut down, we can turn that into fuel, and that's what we can do. And then we can go other places because they got another guy come on the land. He got some land over there in Ghana. We can see how them people do it out there in the bush. See how them bush people build houses and stuff like that. And Bill Hutt.
Well, Darryl, you're on the right track, man. You're thinking like a billionaire. The guy, the Levitt family, that we've talked about on here before, that they were building at one time anywhere from 30 to 40 houses a day. What they did was they would buy forest or a place that had a lot of trees on it, and they would do just exactly like you said. They would harvest those trees and convert it into lumber. So instead of going to a Home Depot or Lowe's, which wasn't around back then, but it was some outlet, but they knew how to convert those trees into old lumber. And I'm sure everybody that's listening to this podcast, because I've got some great uncles that are no longer around. That's what they did. They basically, when they had a child that got married, way before I came along, but that's what they did. They went out and built the house, and they made their own lumber. So that is a skill set. Because instead of going to Home Depot or Lowe's, if you know how to make your own lumber, and you can convert that into an industry. I know I went up in Vermont. I visited a place. There's a little family. You know what? I need to call them and probably have them on this podcast, because essentially it's a family owned. About this mother, I think the father passed. Mother and her sons. They have a lumber mill in this old place I went to visit in Vermont, and they're doing pretty well. So you're right.
No, please do it. Please do it. Please invite them to the show.
Yeah. You're on the right track. And like Pleasant was brought up the other day, we can convert this into scholarship programs for kids. Let me open up 253, Robin. We're looking at creating. Well, let me give you the backstory. There's a group of children and young people out of Taft, Oklahoma, for starters, that they need transportation for their, to attend their basketball games, mm-hmm. soccer games, stuff like that. So the idea is out there that, we figured about $10,000. You know, that might be able to get one or two.
I called her lady today. She did not respond to me. I told her she can call me back. I left a message on her phone.
Okay, she'll respond to you. Yeah, she'll respond to you. So we were thinking of it that, you know what, with that same money, these children can be taught how to build their own electric cars or gasoline cars or tiny houses.
Yes.
And then
they
can have the skill set to keep on doing it, and then they can, instead of trying to get a grant or whatever, they can probably develop a $20,000 a month income as an organization.
A sustainable community-based event. I'll just call it like that. that
right.
Will.
Now, what I like about this idea, because now this is not restricted to Taft. We're starting in. But now, how do you think this would do in your neck?
I think that this model, yes, I think that this model, it's going to work wherever it's at. So you go
right,
in and you identify it. Now, up in the Northwest is full of lumber. You've got Weyerhaeuser. Weyerhaeuser started off as a small community-based, if not even a family-based business. And they did the same thing. They converted wood into lumber. You see? So they took the same idea, and they're using it to sustain their business, their company, their families, and darn near the whole world now, if that makes sense. Yes.
Right,
so
right.
It's going to go well. It's going to go well wherever you're at. And so you just want to keep in mind and be mindful to kind of like pull from what each area, so the Northwest,
right.
Wood, water, mountains, recreation, you know, California, you know, it's going to have its own different merits. Up there you might think about more technology type things and stuff like that. But, yeah, definitely sustainable.
This is a very good idea for practically where you can look up a map. Like I say, you got quite a few people up that way. Let's go to another caller here at area code. And once again, I recommend people, if you haven't already, check out Chapter 10 in, not Carter G. Woodson, Booker T. Washington's book, Up From Slavery. Chapter 10, the solutions that he gave back then, and he just didn't talk about it. They actually did this. These students at Tuskegee built their own accommodations. They built their own classroom building. They took students that didn't know anything about bricks, taught them how to make bricks, and then turn it into a business and then convert it into an industry. This is over 105 years ago when he was living. Okay, I doubt they do that now, but they did it then. So what I'm saying is what Booker T. Washington did, which is he talks about it in Chapter 10 in the book Up From Slavery, those strategies can be applied to today in 2019. So I highly recommend that. Next caller here, area code 314, your mic is open.
What do you say, L.A.?
How's it going? I'm about 99%. I'm good.
You know, you're talking about making bricks. The Italians done that in the St. Louis area on the hill. They had brick cleans. And many of the bricks that was used in the building of apartment buildings and houses in North St. Louis, which happened to be predominantly black, came from those bricks that was built in South St. Louis, which happened to be predominantly white, done by the Italians. They also had salt mines, too, that they worked in. These brick cleans were located, this operation was going on right adjacent to O'Fallon Tech High School, a school that I went to. And I played on the baseball team. We would walk out, take a shortcut to go through there to get over to Oakland, where we went under a tunnel to come out into the park to the baseball field. And I would see these round-shaped, dome-shaped these structures that they was baking brick in. So it's funny that you mentioned that. because that's what Booker T. Washington was doing at Tuskegee.
Yeah, I was reading chapter 10, and then I listened to his audio book on YouTube, and then in Tallahassee, Oklahoma, they had what was interesting in the book, Out from Slavery, by Booker T. Washington. He was talking about during slavery times how, you know, whites looked down on manual labor and blacks looked down on, slaves. But he was looking at, a lot of people had the wrong point of view on manual labor because of the skill set that you can develop from it. And one of the schools that is no longer standing in Tallahassee, Oklahoma, was they opened up a it was a college, a manual labor college, teaching people, you know, how to get a skill set quickly and get a job with manual labor. So
I couldn't understand why come they would look down upon it. What else was there? Wasn't no technology to the point back in those days that would take people,
I know when I was coming through the school, because I went to a private parochial school, but which was focused on academics. But if I would get out of line as a teenager, my mother and all her circle of friends would threaten you. You know what, if you keep this up, I'm going to take you out and put you in a vocational school. So they used it as a threat. Looking back at it.
That was silly.
I know. Yeah. Looking back at it, I wish I had a skill set coming out of 12th grade where I can lay bricks, carpentry, electrician. I wish I had that skill set because later on, when I taught in the D.C. school system, I was at one of those vocational schools, and you had kids 14 and 15-year-olds that were plumber helpers that were probably making more money than I was making.
O'Fallon Tech had everything. It had aero mechanics, auto body, bake shop where they was baking food. They had cosmetology.
Yeah.
Sheet metal, welding.
Yeah.
It had plumbing, like you mentioned, pre-engineering, nursing.
They look down on the manual labor because they associate it with slavery, and they it's silly like you say because it's there have been generations of our people that have made really good money and have left legacies for their families doing manual labor, and they didn't have to have a high school diploma or a college degree to have those jobs either.
Right.
Making good money.
I've known
so.
maintenance people, janitors, whatever you want to call them, they sent their kids to Ivy League schools, and then looking back at it, if you're a good handyman, you can always get money. Always get money.
In the five basic trades, in commercial trades, you got carpentry, you got sheet metal, pipe fitters, you got iron workers, and you got plumbers. Heck, iron workers, when they retire after about 30, 35 years, their yearly pension is about $75,000 a year. That's just the pension, not including the annuity. And if you, in some places, like in New York, those people are making over $100 an hour with wages and benefits. $100 an hour. When they retire, they may have accumulated over $500,000 in annuities that they pay into themselves. Their insurance, health insurance, which they call welfare, you can go in and have a tooth pull. You can have a splinter in your finger, and there's no copay. It's all taken care of. So they have excellent plans coming out of the building trade. So people say, I don't know what the premise is. And, you know, blacks are trying hard to get into the building trades nowadays.
Yeah,
and they were learning from it back then.
And we forget about the labor unions are still an accessible way to accomplish that. You don't have to go in the military, you know, and you can go down to the welding union, the laborers union, the electric union, and become an apprentice, okay, and learn on the job training and get benefits and a living wage at all of that. You know, so, you know, I'm not really encouraging unions, but I'm encouraging going to the unions for the purposes of getting work and creating opportunities for our youth as well.
I encourage unions because I came up in one, and also I was an employer.
Uh-huh.
I had a business doing the same thing, and I use union work. As a matter of fact, the guys I worked with, they all quit who they was working for, came to work for me. Well, heck, it was one, I know one black operating engineer, people that operate cranes. He was operating the crane over at a hospital complex here in St. Louis. Just, I guess, last year they finally completed that. The tower crane up that goes up around. He said he was earning about $5,700 a week. Which is good money.
Yeah.
How much a week?
$5,700 plus.
They got strict in New York because a lot of cranes was falling down. So a lot of them guys, they real strict when it comes to the cranes in New York. Because a few of them have down.
That's a serious skill set.
And see, here's another thing too. When you belong to those trades, you can go any place in the continental 50 states and work.
And work. Yes.
If they need help, they'll put out the call and people will what they call boom. Because I went up when they was building the Sears Towers in Chicago, I went up there and worked because we was on strike here. I worked at the U.S. Steel South Works plant. I've done a job out in Schaumburg, Illinois, a recreation center. So if you're a member of the industry.
All up and down I-5 corridor from Washington to California.
I worked on a building up in Detroit off Highway 75 across the street from the only landmark I know is the Highway Patrol office. And heck, they had Indians that came out of Canada that was working on their job, that was iron workers. So it's very good, a lot of fun.
Yeah, they got these
but
things
you know
going
what
on.
I wanted to
share with me your take. I've heard them on Naima's blogs just a couple of times. Why any explanation on like in? I'm just speaking on Chicago. In Chicago, you don't. I think it's what? How many black unions you have there, as compared to whiteness?
How many who?
Unions.
Oh, they got one black construction union that was created because of the problem they was having with the white one. You know, Arthur Fletcher, his Philadelphia plan, he took to Chicago, and they tried to kill him. The union bosses was going to have him killed because he was having a plan to let blacks in. And that's when Richard Nixon contacted old man Daley, who was the mayor of Chicago, and told Daley that if y'all harm a hair on this black man's head, I would have the 82nd Airborne marching down Michigan Avenue come Monday morning.
In 10 minutes, yeah. I remember that. Wow.
But he was talking earlier about immigration, and I like that that guy that was talking about how illegal immigrants affect blacks is absolutely is true. It don't make any sense for the Congressional Black Caucus, Barack Obama, to have the policies that he had because, you know, he wasn't. I can't stand that man. But the policy that they had on open borders was just totally ridiculous. You know damn well that these illegals have an effect on African Americans. And it does not necessarily have to be the one that's working on medieval jobs. Look at the professions. You got people that's coming from countries where they obtain skill based on a whole line of agreements, where the United States provide aid, where they can take that aid and build the latest in technology and facilities in order to train their people. Mm-hmm. And rather than work in the country, they want to come here where they make more money and they send the equivalent if they stayed in the country back home and wait in the money as if they was back home working, and they still able to live here on the rest. No, anybody that comes to this country need to come in documented.
With a senior education too, doing that.
If I go any place in Africa, I gotta have a visa stamp in my passport, and that's it. I was listening to Steph, and I don't agree with that. United States became a country after the passage, the ratification of the U.S. Constitution. I think that was in 1790. Anything that happened before that, this was North America. So people can come in and walk, but not no more. They have to come in the right way. Anyone that's here illegal need to be gotten out like last week.
Well, it's not going to happen.
Well, they working on it, and some of them are self-deporting.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I'm about 99%. Actually, I feel 100%.
And
so,
you know, you was talking about building those cars. That's a provision. I'm gonna tell you something. You have what's called new car graveyards, where there's millions of brand new cars that dealers don't sell. Did you know that?
I didn't know that, but I believe it. Because
they got pictures of them.
In this country, there's so much production that you really don't have to. I mean, you can go on Craigslist or Free Cycle or through Facebook group, and basically you can get in. You can furnish a whole new house, including the clothes on your back, and not pay retail prices because there's a lot of overproduction in this country.
But these graveyards have hundreds of thousands of brand new cars that's sitting there, especially in the desert. And also up in New York, they have one too. But they just rusting. And they won't sell them because they say if people buy these, then it will cut production, affect production, also their dealerships.
And they need the production so that the people can work and live. So. Wow.
Absolutely.
What a waste. This is ridiculous. Boy, you know what? I keep telling you, we're doomed, y'all. This is silly. This world that we're living in the United States is silly. We're doomed.
It's like that also over in Europe, too. It's not just the United States. They have the same type of thing there, too.
East Germany, they got, like, brand-new office buildings never occupied. Brand-new. Matter of fact, China, some parts of China, cities, virtually nobody living in this city.
They built them in Angola like that too, Chinese did. I think Chinese is talking about spreading around the world. People going to put a stop to that stuff.
Why?
Overproduction. More on that next week. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the week.
At Jiffy Lube, we care about cars. In fact, we're kind of obsessed. That's why we've been taking care of business with quick quality oil changes and service for over 40 years. And with things like our Carful Vehicle Review, where our experts will check, fill, clean, and inspect your vehicle, you'll know we'll car for your car like we car for our own. Jiffy Lube. Car more.
Visit JiffyLubeDC.com to find a Jiffy Lube service center near you.